With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp, not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made with the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
Off the ball, rugby.
The big shot from Sam Prendergast on James O'Connor. Like we've talked a lot ad nauseum around his physicality. If it's there once, it's there multiple times.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. 18 plus gamblingcare.ie.
This is Oos Talk.
Right, you're very welcome back. Delighted to be saying that John Bruin is on the line. John, club football back this weekend. I don't know if the world has gone completely topsy-turvy, but we're in a world where some of us anyway didn't want the international break to end. I saw some people say, oh no, a 5-month club break before we have international football back again. I don't know how you found it from a more neutral perspective, because obviously from an English point of view, you guys had what you always have, which is a kind of, you know, only the tournaments matter really at this stage, apart from some tabloid conversation around the team and everything else. But from Ireland's point of view, from Scotland's point of view, from Wales and all of the surrounding nations to England, it was like such a remarkable week.
It was fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. I watched, you know, day upon day, there's a great story breaking, isn't there? And Ireland, of course, leads that. Though you might say over here, the Scottish...
I think Scotland, if you're to be neutral and fair about it, I think Scotland surpassed by the fact that they actually qualified and it was equally as last minute.
Yeah. And, you know, those ecstatic scenes in the commentary box and stuff like that. I mean, listen, Troy Parrott, that is a moment. That's a moment that will adorn any end of season review or any end of decade review. It was wonderful. But yeah, for Scott, I mean, this is the problem. One of the problems of being English is most of us don't actually mind other countries getting on so well. It's just that the rest of us don't want our country to do well. And we just have to accept that. And I understand why too, you know. With a big daddy, and let's not go into the various other reasons, but yeah, and you know, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's a bit Premier League centric, isn't it? This whole idea of oh God, you know, oh the international break. Okay, that's that November qualifiers. There's always stories breaking, but international weeks in recent times have actually been quite interesting, and there are decent stories, even if you're in the England camp, though. I'm sort of rather glad I don't actually do the England beat that much these days, because it can be slim pickings, and let's just say a few journalists have got themselves into trouble this week by looking for something that maybe is not there, you know.
I wasn't going to talk about that actually, but it just does feel like the whole Bellingham story, and it's almost created a cloud in the it was there anyway, but as the week has gone on, obviously we had Ian Wright yesterday kind of making a speech, that's blown it up a little bit. But it does put a bit of a grim feeling around the English team and the media and everything like that, that I don't think has been there in quite a while, that is surprising almost, that we're kind of back to, I don't know whether it's World Cup silly season and once you kind of get into pre-camps and everything like that, this all goes away, but it wasn't the most pleasant thing this week.
No. Listen, what Ian Wright said, I think made a lot of sense, though I would say, knowing the journalists who have been essentially accused of that, I don't think that was their intent. But you know, that was something that came to mind, is that it is often players of colour that receive this treatment. And, you know, you saw Gary Neville's comments about Raheem Sterling back in 2016. And, you know, Raheem Sterling, if you take Euro 2020, was England's best player until the semi-finals and the final. And there was a lot of doubt in him. And I always felt a bit odd about that, because he got a lot of stick, which I felt was unwarranted. The Bellingham thing is more complicated than... It's to do with the fact that, weirdly enough, we don't really know Jude Bellingham, because he's not really played Premier League football. He is very well managed by his family, and they deliberately took him out of the Premier League firing line, it would appear, to further his career. He had the talent to become a Dortmund player and a Real Madrid player, and therefore there is an enigmatic quality to them. And I think a couple of journalists maybe have misread that and taken meaning from stuff. And no player, particularly a player of Bellingham's talent and of that top bracket, you know, the you know, Wayne Rooney, for example, or Cristiano Ronaldo would play every game they could possibly, you know, Copa del Rey game in Ronaldo's case when he went to Real Madrid, or a League Cup game, those two, and Rooney would do the same. The top players want to play every game, and Bellingham presumably sees himself in that bracket, and that's what's happened. And, you know, I've done an England game earlier in March this year, where Tuchel subbed off Bellingham because he'd been booked, because he didn't want him to be suspended. And because Bellingham is such a star, because he's such an enigma, that was the, I was doing the quotes piece that night, that was the lead line, that was the best line from the press conference. And that wasn't meant in any sense against Bellingham. It's just what comes out. And maybe there's an aspect which, if you compare it to Gareth Southgate, who did dampen down this type of thing, a much more diplomatic figure than Thomas Tuchel. And Tuchel is a guy who likes to be the alpha male in the room. And maybe there's an issue between him and Jude Bellingham that's actually the problem, rather than that between the press and Bellingham, the player. It's all going to play out, isn't it?
Yeah,
Tuchel is here, not for a long time, for a good time, he hopes. we shall see how that plays out in the World Cup. But England will not go to the World Cup without Jude Bellingham. So it's something that everyone's going to have to manage.
As you say, John, you're not on the England beat most of the time, but you are within the circles of...
Sure.
Is the English press... I suppose once bitten, or, you know, 56 times bitten by Shy, afraid to go and say England should win this World Cup, or can win it, or have a real chance of winning it? Because they're, you know, that when England were the quintessential quarterfinal team, as we always said, and, you know, the golden generation wasn't clicking and everything like that, the English press was always derided for, you know, England are going to win the World Cup, you know. And I know it's sometimes the front pages rather than the back pages and so on, but there was always this sense of getting behind the guys, and then, like, as soon as they don't win, they perform to expectations and take them down. But I feel like it's a much more mature press corps these days, and it's almost like you're afraid to kind of say what is true, is that England should at least go in there as one of the top possibly 3-4 teams that have a chance of winning this World Cup.
Well, I mean, with the exception of a couple of people, the days of the Fleet Street Thunderer are gone.
Yeah,
you know, the back page, we should win this, which sold newspapers. And we're in a different world now, aren't we? We're in the world of the internet. We're in the world of people want to read interesting stories. Oddly, those that run editorial teams will tell you that England stories don't do great figures compared to a Manchester United story.
Yeah.
Or weirdly enough, the Republic of Ireland story smashed all servers here at Guardian. So, you know, because it was an interesting story. It was a break from the other international stuff that people find humdrum. But, when I think back to those days, I remember as a kid watching, say, Terry Venables when he was a pundit, just saying England should win this World Cup, and be very surprised a coach as cultured as Terry Venables would say such a thing, because there was no reason, considering the team that we had, that we always had an inferiority thing. So this is one of the weird things about the English mentality. Those in the rest of these aisles may think that we're all brash and confident and all the rest. There isn't actually. There's a real self-loathing within the English, I find, and I am certainly one of those. But this idea that our players might be better than those from around the world, it's only just since the Premier League became so dominant, we've actually got used to that idea. You know, Harry Kane going to Germany completely dominating. Mm. And having a player like Jude Bellingham, who is a real star at Real Madrid, it's not a familiar feeling for the English. We always felt that inferiority complex. And say, Italia 90, we get to the semi-final, it's such a great surprise. And then we've been to two finals, that one of which England should have won, the Italy game and Euro 2020. Funny enough, it felt to me that everyone felt a bit more comfortable being gubbed by Spain. It was This feels more normal. This is what we're used to. You know, the sight of a harried Englishman, or Declan Rice, whichever you want to say, being chasing after the ball as a continental holds onto the ball and plays fantastic football. We're used to that idea. And also, the other thing is that as Englishmen, and Irishmen as well, actually, we're obsessed with the weather. Now, the great problem as far as English people consider the World Cup in the US is the heat, of course. Yeah. And we've all seen Paul Scholes sweating cobs on a foreign field and not being able to do what he could do on a Saturday afternoon at Old Trafford. And I think that's the great fear. And, you know, you go back to USA 94, which obviously England weren't out, but we watched Tommy Coyne sweat blood. We watched John Aldridge rowing with officials. We watched Jack Charlton, you know, with a cap on to shield his head. And that's the expectation, that England will wilt at some point, and a team that could play better football or more, could hold on to the ball better than the English, are going to take them apart. But as you say, when you've glanced through the qualifiers and you look at, say, Argentina and Brazil, they're not fantastic. They're not great teams. England have more talent within the team. It's just whether they have the fortitude, the belief, and whether Thomas Tuchel can meet that very short mission.
Yeah, and they haven't done it before, which is always which brings us nicely on to the club weekend, and we'll talk about Arsenal in a minute and what might ultimately stop them from getting there. But before we do, the welcome back to club football was probably never more stark than the announcement today that we're all going to have to learn two new acronyms in our ever-evolving accountancy education. The Premier League voting to change the financial rules. We won't get into that, right? But I suppose with the last week the way it was, like, would it suggest to you that there might be like a tiring, I suppose, with the ever-increasing role of like the business side of club football? It's such a part of our discussion now. It's such a part. Everybody arguing about how much your team is spending, how much you're allowed to spend, everything. Like there's a kind of a nerd game to it that's kind of good. But other than that, like, it is taking up so much real estate in our discussions rather than the game itself these days. And I wonder about the purity of what we saw in the last week or two. Maybe there's something in the fact that maybe it's all gone a little too far.
Yeah. And listen, if you have 20 clubs and they are run by a combination of state ownership and investment capital from the United States, it all turns a bit business. You know, that was always my fascination with the NFL when it was pretty big over here in the 80s and 90s, was that idea that at the Super Bowl, the captain of the team is not handed the trophy.
Yeah.
It's handed to the owner. And it feels like the Premier League's gone that way, isn't it? It's about ownership. So you have a Premier League meeting on the Friday where they discuss rather complicated, regulations, and it's a power play, and it's what everyone's arguing about, and anchoring and fight. It's like, is this football, you know, anchored? What's the song, you know, anchored to five times of the bottom that came team of the was relegated? You'll never see that. It's that's what we're operating on at this point, aren't we? And it's a space race of finance. And it's a couple of interesting things, I suppose, is that clubs are no longer just able to sell a women's team and do the stadium dodge and things like that, which is good, because stuff like that takes away from the game's purity, doesn't it? The idea that Ireland, a small nation in which soccer may not be the prime sport, finds itself, you know, with a chance of going to the World Cup, it is fantastic. It really is. And the purity of finding a player like Troy Parrott to get the job done, rather than, you know, buying him from a, you know, a foreign country because he's available. That's the beauty of the international game. And the thing is that there can be a purity in club football. But actually, one of the more regrettable things in club football is that the young players who are the beating heart of any club, the ones that the fans should be able to relate to, are sold off for pure profit. You know, Paul Scholes, Gary Neville, Ryan Giggs might have been flogged off for pure profit. And you know, for someone like me, you can't even countenance that, but that's what goes on. And so the Premier League, and, you know, I'll be at a Premier League game this weekend. I've got Fulham, Sunderland, and what are we talking about there? Well, Fulham have an issue with which the manager hasn't been backed in the transfer market because they the ownership have built a stand, which is very luxury. I've been into it. It's a very interesting place. A stand that looks away from the pitch, which is interesting. Its focus is away from the football. It's a membership club, you know, the high end, and there is no relation to football within that. And that's sort of how things are going, because it's an extra revenue stream for the ownership. And then you've got Sunderland, who actually, if we're talking purity, and they are owned by a member of the Dreyfus family, a multi-billionaire, you know, oligarchical family. But they've restored some element of purity, haven't they? Because they have smart dealing, they've got local lads, and the stadium, like being back in the Premier League, has made you remember how fervent that game against Arsenal, the Premier League, it's the Premier Passions. Remember that documentary with Peter Reid? That was the club, Premier Passions. How much it meant, and they obviously had the Sunderland Till I Die documentary that told you how much it means to that city. And civic pride isn't that much different to national pride, is it? And that's where the Premier League can be at its best. But when it's owned by transnational corporations, it moves away from that, doesn't it?
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made with the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, it's funny. I think, like, it's all there, and maybe these rules are for the better, as you say, but there's something, just even the fact that we're so bogged down in them a lot of the time.
Yeah.
There's something just kind of slightly off. But at the same time, that is me saying it on the back of two rounds of fixtures that went really, really well in a completely different game, as we probably have to see international football as now. And once we get into this weekend, we'll all be back in and all of this will be forgotten.
Oh, yeah.
And Arsenal Spurs isn't a bad way to kind of kick it off as the main event of this weekend. And there's a lot of Arsenal fans, one of whom presents this show usually, who just in a constant panic at the moment because it's all going to fall apart, and Man City are ominous, and Gabriel is injured, and, you know, they conceded goals at last to Sunderland and so on. But I think it goes back to what I was saying about England, and until Arsenal do it, nobody's going to believe that they can do it.
No. And doing it the first time is the hardest bit, though, actually, as Liverpool have shown. Winning it again is possibly even harder, but to do that, you've obviously got to do it first. But, you would expect if Arsenal won the title, then they would fancy themselves of doing it again and again because they have such a strong squad, and then they would have the inner self-belief. But at this point, they've only played 11 games. After the 10th game, they were anointed title winners.
Yeah.
Then they draw at Sunderland, Manchester City win, and suddenly the panic sets in. They get a, let's be fair to Arsenal and Arsenal fans, and a lot of them point this out. They've had a few injuries. They're stacking up. Calafiori is another doubt. People like Gabriel Jesus have not played any football. They've had issues with injury. They've also been completely dominant until that Sunderland game. They're against a Spurs team who I think will be relieved not to be playing at their home because they have the second worst home record after Wolves, though they haven't won at the Emirates since 2010 in the Premier League. So it's a huge fixture for both clubs. And we're about civic pride, aren't we? If you ever go to these games, it's the atmosphere is red hot. And, I've been to, when I was growing up, I went to United, Liverpool, United City, stuff like that, that felt white hot. And you were like, it's not the same down in London, but actually it is. And it's also got that London element, and they're a bit more pernickety, a bit more snide with each other. It's like, they really lay into each other, and it gets pretty heated, and they genuinely loathe each other. And it's like a bit, are you really this serious about it? Because, Scousers and Manx get on really in the end of it, whereas this lot genuinely don't like each other. And weirdly enough, I think there were six seasons where Tottenham finished above Arsenal in the sort of post-Wenger or end of Wenger era, that great period under Poch. And now they're trying to find themselves. They've actually won a trophy, which Arsenal haven't done for some time. Mm. It's a strange time in North London because Arsenal have focused purely on winning the title. This will be the fourth season when they've been in contention. Tottenham have been up and down of Antonio Conte. They've had big hands. They've had, and the focus of this game actually is Arsenal going for the title. And it's, weirdly enough, it's a really important North London derby, one of the most important you can remember. But it's the 12th game in the season. Yeah. And it's a huge game. And if they wobble in this fixture, well, the great big looming Erling Haaland, now accompanied by Gianluigi Donnarumma and Pep, the master, and they start to worry, don't they?
I think so, yeah. And, at the same time, I think if they win this weekend, maybe it calms down a little bit and they, the sense of, I don't know. Again, I really don't understand where, I think it's probably because Sunderland made them look mortal. Perhaps, having not conceded in so long and showed maybe a way of playing against them. And then you add Gabriel getting injured, who is seen as a sort of the glue that holds it all together. From Tottenham's point of view, it's because we're talking about the derby and the fans and how they react. It's funny thinking about where Spurs are, because it almost goes back to what we were talking about with the business side versus the football side. Because if you look at where Spurs were all my life growing up, they were a hopeful team, a big club, not quite in the doldrums, but not far off. And what they've done in the last 10 years has genuinely been brilliant. It hasn't gone to that next level, but in that time, they've also got like the best stadium in the country and everything else, right? Their profile has gone through the roof. They're a regular Champions League team, but a lot of that's the business side, and fans want to beat Arsenal. And it is funny, there just isn't, it doesn't feel like there's any level of patience at Spurs anymore, that we're so early in the Frank era and there's such mumblings. I know it's a style of play issue and so on, but it does feel like that just comes from a case of like, as much as we've improved, we're still a bit Spursy here compared to these guys.
I think you make a good point. I've made a similar point, which is, you know, I saw a lot of Brentford when Thomas Frank was a manager, and I really do like him as a person, as a manager. You saw how he essentially built Brentford. Okay, they have a back office which is admired across the game, but he was the front man for a very impressive organisation. Obviously, Keith Andrews has replaced him, doing okay, but now he's at a different club. And I made this point, maybe give Frank a bit of patience. And it was put to me, listen, considering how much money we as Tottenham fans have to pay to go to this stadium, and the team is rubbish at this stadium. And this is the thing, Tottenham, in creating that stadium, didn't create the best team to go with that stadium. And what you do if you have you are a business, it becomes a customer base rather than a group of fans. It's not supporters. And, you know, there is such a thing as the customer being right, a customer being satisfied. And, you know, I've been to Tottenham as a fan with some friends. I saw them play Doncaster Rovers in the Carabao quite recently. It's a great experience. It really is. It's great to watch football. You get a great view. You know, the beer flows well. You know, the pies are great. The food's good. You can have a late drink after. It's all there. The thing that's missing is the team. Now, the team is in fifth place, or, you know, has a chance of finishing in the Champions League. It's playing in the Champions League. But when you have that expectation, you have to meet it as a football team. And they didn't play great football under Ange after this initial experiment. They won a trophy. And weirdly enough, I think that sort of turned Tottenham fans' heads, and they've thought, actually, what would it like to win it be glory, glory Tottenham Hotspur as it was in the 60s? And that's a long time ago. And listen, the difference between fans down south in England and up north is, down south, I've noticed, I've been here a long time, 25 years, they get after you if you're not good. Mm. They get after you far more than they would at, say, Old Trafford or Liverpool or even Everton, you know, or the old Manchester City. And they feel they have a right to complain that it's not going as they'd like. Even though a lot of clubs would look around and say, I'd like to be in that position. Mm. But when you're paying a lot of money, it's not, and you know, you're paying a lot of money. And I suppose the one thing is that the stadium is Daniel Levy's legacy. Daniel Levy is no longer with the club. He was unceremoniously removed. I mean, it was a pretty, you know, night of the long knives thing. Suddenly he's there, suddenly he's gone. Mm. He's there 1 minute, he's gone the next. The family, the Joe Lewis's children that now run the club. Now, in Thomas Frank's case, there is a risk that because Thomas Frank is Levy's last appointment, he's under risk, because we've seen it a million times, haven't we, where a new ownership comes in, the manager's the first out the door, and that might be the problem. Thomas Frank will get another job elsewhere, I'm sure, and we, you know, but the football is, he's almost too pragmatic. He's looked at the players and said, we've got to play it this way, and it suits playing away from home more than it does playing, you know, the fans expect them to attack and play, you know, the football of Glenn Hoddle, the glory game, you know, and it's not possible in the Premier League. And Ange failed at that. And Thomas Frank has put them in a more secure basis, but it just doesn't set hearts racing. And the team are not great at home. And fans come away from the White Hart Lane or to the Tottenham Stadium and they think, this should be better. But the thing is, Arsenal had that experience for a long time, didn't they, when they moved to the Emirates? It's not their home just yet. It will be one day.
Maybe when it gets a name. I just don't understand why they don't call. Why did it? It's still in the same place, isn't it? Or more or less. Could they not have still?
They could have still called it
like the something that you could sponsor. Heart Lane, or, you know, anyway, I don't know. I never understood why the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium was the way forward. But Newcastle versus City, then quickly, we're almost out of time, and I just want to ask you about one more thing before we go. But do you share the Arsenal fans, I suppose, panic that there's something inevitable and ominous about City? Because from my perspective, I was saying this earlier, is I feel like once you lose it, you lose it. So while there is a sense that City are a title challenger, the idea of them just being able to turn it on and go on a 13-game win streak like they might have 2-3 years ago, I don't think that fear is there anymore. They, when they played Villa, like, that's not that long ago, they created one chance in that whole game. And I know they've played well either side of it, but they're going to have to go on these kind of runs. And I don't know if we're absolutely sure. It's not that they won't do it, but we're not sure that City are just going to go and win, you know, get 90 points.
Yeah, I think they're more fallible than people maybe recognise. I think Pep knows that. I think, weirdly enough, the thing that I've noticed with Pep is he's enjoying football more than he used to. It's like he's almost enjoying this challenge. He's enjoying working with players that are not ready-made, bought for him. And funny enough, they would buy players for him that are ready-made, and then he'd remould them. You know, you'd say, well, yeah. Bernardo Silva's bought as a number 10 and is now this, you know, almost box-to-box, all-action midfielder that can play across, you know, and a real dirty sod as well. And it's like, well, that was supposed to be a flair player. And he has recreated these players. And, you know, you've got a player like Nunes is now created as a right back. Rodri, obviously, has had his injury problems. So Nico Gonzalez, you know, he's enjoying pushing these players through. It's almost like he's back at Barcelona B, isn't it? He's like, this is fun. And the thing is, though, you've got Haaland, who, you know, he's mid-20s now, and he's thinking, he played with all these top players that won everything in the game. He won the Champions League with them, and he's taking on that responsibility. I was at the Brentford game quite recently, and there was a interchange between him and Donnarumma. Now, Donnarumma's won the Champions League, and he's won the Euros. There was a sort of game-recognised game thing. You know, we're winners. We're the alpha males around here. And there was a point, actually, where Pep and Haaland were arranging things with each on the sideline. And I thought, that's interesting. And you don't really see that, do you? He didn't have that relationship with an alpha male like Zlatan Ibrahimovic, for example. And we know he had his run-ins with Messi. Yeah. So Pep's changed a little bit. But I do think that because those players are new, and because, you know, you've got the players like Nico O'Reilly, who's an excellent player, but he's only in his second season or so, and they are going to be fallible. But there is something of, and let's say that City fans won't like this, let's compare it to one of my favourite seasons as a Manchester United fan was the season that when they won it. You know, you don't win anything with kids, but actually the kids had Steve Bruce, Peter Schmeichel, Roy Keane around them.
96, players to, was it, yeah.
95, 96 yeah. to guide them on. And if they win the title, City fans will enjoy that because it is these, you've got young players. Okay, Phil Foden's been around, but you've got Mancunians playing for the team and, you know, Rico Lewis and stuff like that. It feels like we were talking about before, provincial pride, this civic pride. It feels like more of a Manchester team than teams have done before. And maybe that can take them a long way because no one else is that good in the Premier League. Arsenal's dominance at the start of the season showed that they had the best squad. You've seen Liverpool's fall because they... the word from Liverpool these days is actually watch us next season. It's got to that point, which is crackers when you spend however much money. But City are those that can stop Arsenal. But I agree with you that it's not perfect yet. And if they get an injury to Haaland, that's it, isn't it? It's a free run for Arsenal.
Before I let you go, John, instead of talking about United and Everton on Monday night, I know you anyway, whether I'm right or wrong, as a music fan. You're from the Northwest, obviously. Were you a Stone Roses Manny man?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Very sad news.
Yeah, I'd just driven back from up north yesterday, you know, my website message flats comes up as I'm parking up. You know, when I was 13, 14 years old, the Stone Roses were everything. You know, that they knew how to be a music fan. They taught you about fashion. I was talking in the office today. I went to the 1990 FA Cup final. United were there. Everyone's wearing a Rennie hat. Everyone's wearing a Paisley shirt. They were so influential on that time. And I actually met him a couple of times. In fact, you know, both amazing. Sort of, I met him. I went to Barcelona 99 when United won the the treble, the Champions League, first bar we went into on Las Ramblas. Manny's there with his wife, who he'd lost a couple of years ago. Big smile on his face, everyone walking in. You know, we all had a smile, let's face it. It was the best night of our lives. And another time I met him at Glastonbury, I had a George Best t-shirt on, and he came over and we were talking about England had just gone out of the Euros the night before. And yeah, just an everyman figure, a brilliant musician. I've seen him play with Primal Scream many times. Eventually saw them with the Roses. You know, I was a bit too young when their actual heyday, but a great guy, you know, and I was the heart of that band. And if, from a football point of view, he was the football guy among the band. Yeah. I mean, John Squire and Ian Brown are the, you know, both Reds, and Rennie was a Blue, but he was the guy. There's some videos on YouTube of United fans getting up to all sorts in the 80s, and you see a young man with that sort of Perry Boy hairstyle, that, you know, the flop fringe hairstyle that he had at the time. He was a man about town, and I was very sad to hear about it. And he'll be missed. And I know that he was talking about wanting to come back and be out there again. And I think he had a speaking tour book which would have sold out everywhere. So yeah, very sad. Very sad. A top Red, top man. Goodbye, Manny.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well said, John. Thank you for that. And enjoy the weekend anyway. And we'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, mate.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by William Hill. Download the app and play today. 18 plus gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Off the Ball. Rugby.
The big shot from Sam Prendergast on James O'Connor. Like we've talked a lot ad nauseum around his physicality. If it's there once, it's there multiple times.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.